Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to our new podcast series celebrating Black History Month. We are taking ourselves through a five-episode odyssey that will come to you for the next 5 weeks, taking in the significance and the magnificence of all manner of areas of the world that have supplied just the most iconic of black footballers. So the British Isles primarily, but we'll also throw in a little bit of global context via my wingman for this series, who is Dave Bowler. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening. Looking forward to going through this, trawling through the world and reliving a few great names of the game that have made a big contribution to not just to football, but I think particularly in this country, I think to society in general.
Exactly. And a few names that might be less familiar that need illuminating as well along the way, I am sure. Our experts for this series, you might have remembered them from a podcast from a couple of years back. They are the authors, the co-authors of Football's Black Pioneers, the stories of the first black players to represent the 92 league clubs, which was released in 2020. Welcoming back to the TFT podcast, we have the wonderful Bill Hearn and David Gleave. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be back.
Oh, looking forward to this. I think it'll be a wonderful odyssey in the next five episodes. And you've come up with five beautifully themed episodes. Looking forward to it very, very much. And David, welcome, David Gleave.
Well, Bill stole my line. It's great to be back. Nice to see you again. Looking forward to it.
Yes, it's going to be a really good a good sojourn around the globe. I'm really looking forward to it. Tonight we are launching ourselves into Africa, a continent that is rich for football in talent, and you know, just the most incredible of stories from you know, the past to the present and everything in between. It has been, you know, one of the most amazing parts of the world for, you know, the production of players. And not just that, it's the outlook, it's the way that football is embraced by African players, and the way that they use their fame as well, so many of them, to, you know, enhance the people that they grew up with, the areas that they spring from. Dave, your initial thoughts on our topic tonight?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I think a lot has changed over the years, and a lot of the players that we're going to look at this evening, many of them are from African descent rather than necessarily being born on the continent, because of course they were the pioneers, they were the first ones. But what we've seen in more recent years is a bit of a shift in that we're importing more African players per se, you know, Nigerian footballers, Senegalese footballers, or, you know, Ivory Coast or wherever. And that, I think, has made an interesting shift, and I think it's brought a different sense of responsibility, I think, to the game as well. We'll come on to that a little bit later on, but I think it's brought quite a nice sort of social conscience to football with guys who've got an interest in hinterland and are playing the game, not just purely for playing the game, but are doing something with their fame and fortune, if you like.
That is correct. Bill, take us through some of the trailblazers as far as the English game's concerned with black African footballs.
Yeah, well, we go back a long, long way, you know, back to the 1880s, really, and the first ever black professional footballer in the world, in Arthur Wharton, who was born in Ghana, but it was so long ago, it was still known as the Gold Coast. And Arthur was the son of a minister, a religious minister, and he came across to England to be educated, and he was going to become a minister. But he was just outrageously good at everything. He wasn't just a great footballer. He could cycle, he could play cricket, he could play rugby. And he was also the world record holder for the 100 metres. So a really, really talented person. oddly enough, in spite of his speed, he was a goalkeeper. You would have thought he'd made a great winger or something, but he was a goalkeeper. And I suppose an equivalent these days, or more recently, would be Bruce Grobbelaar. He did a lot of very unorthodox things, swinging on, well, when they invented crossbars, swinging on crossbars and so on. So, yeah, he is very much the pioneer. He was the first black player at Sheffield United, Preston, Stockport. And, well, you probably know he's now got a statue at the England Trinity headquarters at Burton. So he really, really has been remembered, although he was briefly forgotten. He was buried in a pauper's grave in, I think, 1930. And it was only through the work of a guy called Sean Campbell, who really pushed Arthur Wharton's story very, very hard indeed. And now he's been remembered in the way he should be. So, as I say, we'll go back a long, long way. He's just the beginning. And I think it does surprise people that there were Africans, full stop, whether they were footballers or not. There were Africans in England and Britain long before people imagined there were. I mean, David might want to talk a little bit about the history there, because I know you, you've looked very much at you know, how long Africans have been in Britain, David.
It is interesting. I mean, I think basically there have been people of African descent in Britain since before the Romans. People on this podcast may or may not be aware of that, but there's more and more evidence, a lot of it archaeological, a lot of it sort of testing the bones found in graveyards that predate Roman times. So, I mean, that surprised me. I remember going on a walk around Harewood House near Leeds a year or so ago. And that was the first time I'd heard of somebody called Ivory Bangle Lady who predated the Romans. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of her. Not a footballer, I don't think, but nonetheless, as far as history of black Africans in Britain is concerned, it goes back a very, very long way.
I think we associate African migration to being a more, you know, recent phenomenon. You know, it's amazing to hear stories of, you know, from centuries gone.
Well, one good example is, I mean, not centuries gone, but going back to football, Roy Brown, the first black player to play for Stoke City, his father and his uncle fought for Britain in the First World War. They were living in England at the time. They'd come across to be educated. And when war broke out, you know, they felt it was their duty to sign up. And unfortunately, his uncle, John, was killed in at Passchendaele. And his father, Eugene, was injured, but not he survived the war and had three children, one of them being Roy. Like many people around that time, Roy would have made his debut a lot earlier than he did, but World War II broke out. So he didn't play his first game until 1946, but he did become Stoke's first black player then, and his heritage is Nigerian. And what's really nice about that family is that when they married, it sounds a bit as if conditions weren't perfect. What I really mean is that Roy's mum, when they married, she was only 17 and she was heavily pregnant. She's marrying a black guy from Nigeria. Mixed marriages were not welcome in Britain at the time. So it was a difficult start, but three children all went on to be huge successes. And Roy's brother went on to be the Lord Mayor of Stoke on two occasions. He was a Labour councillor, he was a JP, he was a physiotherapist. So, you know, a lot of good came out of that family. Roy, when he played for Stoke in 46, he was a centre-half. He was converted to a centre-forward later in his career. And he was never a great player, but he did play in Stoke City's team when it reached its highest position ever. In fact, they would have won the First Division in 1947 if they'd won their last game against Sheffield United. Game that was played on the 14th of June, believe it or not, because of the bad winter in 1947. So that's the closest Stoke ever got to the title. Roy's next team was Watford, and the newspapers made great play of the fact that Watford already had a black player, and that the headlines were that it is remarkable that Watford now have two coloured, that, you know, the term of that time, two coloured players in the same team. They didn't play together at that point because Tony Collins actually left Watford in that close season, but they did rejoin later and they became the first, Watford became the first team to field two black players in the same team. And that was only in the 1950s and it was considered remarkable.
Dave, these early players that came through, I think a lot of the evidence that I tend to read, you know, from games of the past and stuff like that, is that they are kind of popular. You know, with the team, the supporters of the teams that they play for, there's a huge popularity of to these players, which kind of flies in the face of the modern context. But we look at the 60s and the 70s when you had that wave of British-born, but you know, second-generation black players that came through that had it so rough. You know, where do you think this schism kind of comes from? Why would there be such a schism that the original trailblazers, the original players to come through, the original black players to reach into the English game, were popular amongst their supporters? Yet, you know, we look at the 70s where players, you know, the 80s as well, where, you know, black players were often booed by their own fans and you know, and also given a rough ride by their own teammates.
I mean, obviously reading Bill and David's book, I mean, it's not, wasn't all plain sailing, even in the 20s before it. But I guess there was a kind of a novelty value in that sense. I mean, at the same time as some of these guys in between the war, I mean, in cricket as well, you know, the Lancashire Leagues, guys like George Edley and Leary Constantine were doing great things there, and they were, you know, beloved in their communities. And I think by the time we got to the 60s and the 70s, obviously, with the Windrush generation and that kind of thing, that was when politicians of a local one around here, Enoch Pell, for instance, was starting to incite the population just based on the it was a numbers game, I suppose, if you like. And then with people like that whipping it up with the National Front coming along in the 70s as well. I mean that then became, well, these guys aren't a novelty, and we're not going to appreciate their skills because they're a threat to us in whatever ludicrous way that, you know, those people used to talk and still do talk, sadly, you know, all these years on. But I think that has to be the real sort of the fork in the road, I guess, when it just became a numbers thing, and black players went from being a pleasing novelty to, God help us, a threat.
I mean, Bill, the reception that the early black Africans got in English football, examples of any examples you can give of the receptions that some of these players got?
Yeah, I can give a couple of examples of the illogicality, really, of fans cheering their own black players and booing the opposing black players. I mean, Chris Kamara, for example, signed for Portsmouth. And you probably remember back in the 70s, Portsmouth had a massive National Front presence. So he felt very uncomfortable about playing in that sort of environment. But the fans never booed him, or the Portsmouth fans certainly didn't boo him. And likewise at Millwall. Millwall, I'm sorry to say, got the worst press. From all the people that we interviewed, the footballers said the worst place to go was Millwall. I didn't want that to happen. I'm not surprised it happened, but it's just a fact. That's what they told us. And their first black player was Frank Peterson, who was, his father was from Ghana. He didn't play for very long, but he was a character. And Trevor Lee, who joined Millwall shortly afterwards. And they were absolutely heroes at Millwall. And I can't use the word, but the Millwall fans that we spoke to said, he might be a N-word, but he's our N-word. And they felt very protective. Yet when Trevor Lee came back with playing for Colchester a year or two later, he got booed, you know, from sort of beginning to end. So there is a definite lack of logic in terms of crowd reaction. The other thing about what was difficult for the early black players, especially the South Africans, we all remember Albert Johansson. There was a Leeds player before him. Jerry Francis was a black South African. Steve McCorney was a black South African. And the massive test that they faced was they were moving from apartheid into a reasonably tolerant culture. But when they got here, they didn't know if they could stand in a bus queue with white people. They didn't know if it could go in a restaurant, cinema, go in the bath with the teammates and so on. So they had a whole new set of rules to learn. And it was been very, very confusing. I know the McCorney found it very, very odd when he got to a hotel and a white man picked up his bags to take them to his room. He'd never been served by a white man before. So the players had difficulty adapting as well.
Dave mentioned a couple of words when he was talking. He talked about numbers game. And I mean, I do think that's when things probably changed. And he also used the word threat. I mean, I think if there were a very small or relatively small number of black players coming into the game, that they weren't perceived as a threat. But let's remember, of course, also that football only reflects really the society around it. So, you know, society at large in the 50s probably didn't perceive black people as much of a threat simply because there were so few of them. That changed. I mean, from the 60s onwards, that did change. And I think that's when the shift in attitudes probably came. You talked about players who were kind of abused. He wasn't from Africa. I mean, obviously, indirectly he was. But if we talk about Walter Tull, who was the first black player at Tottenham and Northampton, I mean, he did experience most terrible abuse in an away game, I think, at Bristol City, I think it was. So bad, I think, that the management at Tottenham really didn't feel that they could play him again after that. And he was sort of frozen out of the Tottenham team, I think, after that. And they were probably only too glad to shift him off to Northampton when an offer came in for him. So, you know, players did experience, you know, appalling racist abuse going right back to Walter Tull's time. And that was in the years just before the First World War. And it could, you know, could damage their careers in a big way, as it did with Walter Tull. Although he did thrive at Northampton, he didn't thrive at Tottenham, probably because of the abuse he faced.
Bill, when it's hard to say that there has completely been a tipping point in the treatment of black players, you know, because there are still intolerances out there. You know, there are still, you know, narrow-minded individuals out there, and it's always going to be the case. But where do you think the dividing line came? It's like a kind of tipping point where right-minded people began to step up and kind of speak, you know, and argue on behalf of the black player in English football. Because there was a time, because I remember it as a child of the 70s and 80s, and, you know, the intolerances, and people would sometimes tut at racism, but they wouldn't really stand up to it. You know, where do you think the tipping point came, where it was deemed by polite society that it wasn't acceptable to take racism, into a football stadium?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very difficult to put a precise date on that. And as you hinted, it hasn't really gone away.
An impossible question in a way, but yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, the living players that we interviewed in the course of the research all tended to play around about the 1970s. And without exception, their attitude was, we just had to get on with it. You know, I know Viv Anderson's not African, but I asked Viv Anderson what would have happened if you'd walked off. And he said, Bill, if I'd walked off, I would have been looking for another job on Monday. And he once famously was warming up and he was getting fruit thrown at him. So he sat back down in the dugout and Brian Clough supposedly said to him, what are you doing? I've told you to warm up. And Viv said, well, I can't, they're throwing fruit at me. And Clough said, well, go back, get me a banana, two oranges, and come back here. But what he did say was, if you don't play, I'll pick somebody else. It's as simple as that. And Chris Kamara in the 70s again, you may remember he had an incident with Jim Melrose where he hit Melrose when he was playing for Shrewsbury, broke his jaw. He actually was charged and convicted of assault. And I don't think Chris Kamara's ever said what it was that triggered it, but the assumption is it was something racist. And after the game, Lou Macari, who I understand Lou Macari is probably one of the nicest men in the world, but the attitude of the 70s was very much, and he said this on camera, Chris has got to understand he's black and nothing's going to change that. So, you know, unless it's a miracle and he changes colour, he's got to treat it as water off a duck's back. So certainly in the 70s, the attitude is very much, get your head down, get on with it. It's just a fact of life. When did it change? It's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, I can't think of any year, any incident. But what I do know is that what's changed is that if there is racist abuse now, players would walk off the pitch and they would be supported. So the trick is, when did that switch happen? Not long ago, I would have said. I certainly can't imagine anybody walking off in the 90s. So this century.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I think John Barnes, who's obviously got that very famous photo of him sort of back kicking a banana, he commented that he thought it was, yeah, he noticed that he thought it was only when a white Frenchman was racially abused that people sat up and took notice. This was when Eric Cantona was sort of responded to abuse from, I'm sorry to say, fans in Crystal Palace's ground. by jumping into them and kung fu kicking the person who he thought had abused him. And John Barr said people started to wake up to the fact then that, you know, that players shouldn't have to tolerate racist abuse. And I actually can't remember the name, the year that that event took place. Perhaps somebody can Google it very quickly while I'm talking.
1995, I think that
95,
was.
Okay. Obviously John Barnes is not the be-all and end-all source of all, fount of all wisdom, but I mean, it's an interesting point that it took that incident for the, perhaps the authorities to start to say something's going wrong here. If a white French bloke feels so incensed that he's going to jump into the crowd and kick a fan, we perhaps ought to be doing a bit more to control it. And I think, I'm not saying that was a turning point, but that was certainly a very interesting incident.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, Dave Bowler, you know, from a perspective of supporters, you know, alluded to it a little early, was that, you know, I think there was a kind of uncomfortable nature among some supporters over racism in football stadiums, but there wasn't quite, I don't know, the bravery to stand up to it, to question it for a long, long time. It was almost kind of like a, you know, there was a silent kind of, I don't know, a silent kind of sympathy for many, many years, before anyone was willing to actually step up and say, hey, you know, you're out of order for this.
I mean, I can recall an incident. I think it must have been 2010. I was at Palace with my mixed heritage son. And towards the end of the game, as the players were trooping off, this was a game against Sheffield United when Neil Warnock was the manager there. And Neil was kind of giving it to the crowd, you know, because I think Sheffield United had won that game. And one or two of the black players on his side were also giving it to the crowd as well. And the bloke next to me sort of shouted out, you black bastard, you know, get out, get off, you black bastard, kind of thing. And I just gave him a look, and I looked at my son and I gave him a look. And the bloke thought, I shouldn't have said that. So that, I think that was around about 2010. So I think the penny dropped with him that it had become unacceptable by then. Now, that's really relatively recent past, and obviously it could have become unacceptable before that. But that's an incident that sticks in my mind as something's changed here, and he knows he shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, well, when we started researching this book, probably 6 years ago now, there was a little bit of an increase in racist activity. And when I questioned the players about this, when I said things, you know, seem to have got better, they all said to a man, that, yeah, it might have looked like it got better, but it had never gone away. It was always there. So I think even now there's a suspicion that it could always resurrect itself, and, you know, has done on occasions.
But I think Bill mentioned about players being willing to walk off now. And there was an incident, actually, when I think both teams walked off. It was in an early round of the FA Cup. It was two non-league teams. It was Yeovil against Haringey or something like that. It was a North London game. And somebody in the, I think it was somebody in the Yeovil fans' end was giving abuse to the Haringey goalkeeper, if I remember rightly. And, you know, Haringey said, this is not acceptable, we're going to walk off. And the Yeovil team said, we're coming off as well. You obviously don't want things like that to happen at all, but it's quite heartwarming that both teams said, no, it's not up. We're not standing for that. We're off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Dave, yes?
Yeah, I think a lot of things coalesced around the 1990s. I think disappearing to the terraces made a difference, because the terraces were a lot more aggressive than sitting behind the goal. It is a different experience to standing behind the goal. I think that calmed people down. I also think it made people more willing to call people out, because they were less likely to get punched in the mouth. For a starter, I think that made a big difference. I think the Premier League, much as I don't like the Premier League in many, many ways, I think the Premier League made a difference, because I think they didn't want their product disfiguring with this kind of stuff. And I think they made it clear to football clubs that this was not going to be tolerated anymore. They didn't want their product besmirching with all this kind of thing. I think that made a difference. I think politically, the country changed in the 90s. There was no more Thatcher. It wasn't quite such a confrontational country for up until Brexit, which I think has probably lifted. Yeah, you know, that Brexit is the lifting the lid on Pandora's box again, I think, and that's why I think there's been a resurgence of all kinds of racism ever since. I don't think it was any one particular thing, but I do think a lot of things came together in the 90s that started a bit of a journey. And then there were things like Kick It Out, which started, was it 92? You know, that began to make a difference. And it just started to be the clubs, organisations, players started to make more of a stance on this sort of thing where, as you say, you know, the Viv Andersons and the Cyril Regis and all those guys, they kept their head down and just got on with it because they had to. People were a bit more outspoken then and they were a bit more involved. And again, I suppose in a different sense, it was a numbers game because in a different way, because there were more and more black players at that point. I mean, you know, we reached a tipping point where we were, instead of one or two black players in the team, we'd gone to five and six in a lot of cases. And again, I think that made a difference. I don't think there was any silver bullet on it. I just think in the 90s, things started to shift in one direction. And unfortunately, the last sort of 5 or 6 years, we probably started to move back in the opposite way, unfortunately.
I think you've made some very good points there. I mean, the point about seating instead of standing, I mean, obviously, I think probably all of us on this, you know, call started to go to football when it was terraces, surging crowds behind the terrace. Every time you scored a goal, you kind of got swept several tiers down the terraces. It, you know, enjoyable in its own way, but you don't get the same kind of atmosphere in a seated stadium. It's more, in inverted commas, civilised, and therefore maybe that sort of behaviour is less tolerated. But the point about the Premier League product is I think a brilliant point. I mean, football probably throughout the leagues, but particularly in the Premier League, it's a product. And as you say, you know, people like the Premier League don't want to be associated with stuff like that. It's got to be sanitized, and that takes away some stuff that used to be really good about supporting a football team. But it's also, obviously also, I think, made it much harder for the nasty stuff to emerge. So I think you made some very good points.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know that, you know, reports, certainly at Anfield, reports of racism, any homophobia, any kind of discrimination is actually quite, you know, it's reported on a regular basis. You know, and you do get the announcements over the tannoy of, you know, an incident has been reported in such a part of the stadium, you know, and asking for people to come forward and things like that. It has become, whereas before the sympathisers of black players were kind of kept silent in so many ways in decades gone by, it's the muffler has been on, you know, the racists that continue to go through the turnstiles because, you know, and we've always pointed out that, you know, what a bastard doesn't like is being pointed out they're a bastard, you know. They like to be able to say everything that they want to say, but not be called a bastard for it. You know, it has been a switch in that respect. You know, racism's never gone away; it'll never go away. But it has become, you know, something that in public utterances is seen as completely unacceptable, unrightly unacceptable. But it doesn't mean it's still not there. You know, and as you've mentioned there, Bill, is that, you know, your experiences of interviewing players, you know, has illuminated that. You know, Dave, you've mentioned your own experiences in you know, where you work previously with West Brom and interviewing players. You know, your own experiences in this respect.
Well, I mean, in terms of supporting, I mean, it goes back to the Holy Trinity of Regis, Cunningham, and Batson, obviously. The proper Holy Trinity, none of this little best Charlton rubbish.
You didn't need much prompting, did you?
No. Well, that was the last time we were
well
really
done.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, some of those times were absolutely horrendous. I mean, I remember, I won't say who the opposition was, but at the Smethwick end was where the opposition fans used to gather for the Albion. And we used to have these sort of asbestos things at the back that, the one game Laurie Cunningham was playing. I'm not sure. I think it may even have been before Cyril started playing. And they were banging and banging against this corrugated asbestos stuff. Every time Laurie got the ball, pull the trigger, shoot the... Yeah, and that wasn't three or four voices. That was 5,000 away supporters. How those blokes got through that stuff. I mean, they should all have medals. They should all be MBEs and OBEs and knighthoods and, you know, the whole lot. Because, I mean, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? And that went on and that was at our ground, you know. So, yeah. I mean, what they were getting when they were going away to other grounds, God only knows.
It's interesting what you say about bravery, Dave, because George Best said that Albert Johansson is the bravest player he ever met. And that was because of the abuse he put up with game after game after game. And George Best said, I couldn't have taken that. I really couldn't. So it was very brave of him to carry on. Of course, we don't know how many didn't carry on. Wolves' first black player, for example, only ever played one game. And there were quite a number who only ever played the one game. Now, were they just not up to it? Or were they broken by the abuse? We can never be sure.
I do just want to go back. I mean, we're talking a lot about racism and the negativity of those years. I just want to thank Dave for mentioning Laurie Cunningham. I mean, I never saw Laurie Cunningham play live. That's one of the things you so wish you'd done. But one of the great pleasures for me of doing the research, I mean, I wrote the West Bromwich Albion chapter, so if there's mistakes in it, it's my fault. But one of the things I did do was look at old YouTube videos of Laurie Cunningham, and just watching those videos was just amazing. One of the best bits of writing the book for me was watching those. So, we should, by all means, let's discuss the racism these players face, and, even more power to Laurie Cunningham and players like him for overcoming it. But what a joy he must have been to watch.
I mean, I must have seen probably half of his games for the Albion. I mean, he was, genius is a much overused word, but he genuinely was a genius. And he did stuff with the ball that, you still don't see players do nowadays. I mean, it was unfortunate that he went to Real Madrid at a time when there were no kind of support systems for players going abroad the way that there are nowadays. But I mean, people don't turn down Real Madrid now. I mean, they certainly didn't turn them down in 1979. So that was never going to happen.
Bill, going back to the African icons and the trailblazers, even some of those the names that fall beneath the radar of most. We all prefer to know our football, but there's always something that we learn and we don't know. Throw us out a few of the names of the players that should be on the lips of everyone.
Peter Foley is such an interesting story. I mean, I won't talk about his backstory as coming down from Scotland. There's a fascinating story there, but the nub of it, he was playing for Workington. And he came down to play an end-of-season game at QPR. And he heard, stuff coming from the crowd. And he looked around, he thought, that can only be directed at me. I'm the only black person here. So that it's obviously directed at me. And he was really intimidated by it. And that was, I think, the final game of that season, or very much towards the end of the season. When the fixtures came out for the next season, his first game was away at Millwall. And he couldn't face going to the Den. He went to the manager and said, "Oh, I'm injured, boss. I'm not going to be able to play this weekend." And so he feigned injury in order to avoid playing at the Den. And he said that was a sort of seminal moment in his whole life, really, because he thought, "I've let my teammates down. I've let myself down. I've let the manager down. I should not have done that." And from that point on, he became a committed anti-racist. I mean, he's really campaigned throughout the rest of his life against racism, not just in football, but in society as a whole. And he's a really wonderful man, I think. We've got a video of a little interview with him on our site. Peter Foley is somebody we should talk about much more. I mean, I think one of the things you wanted to do on these podcasts is talk about sort of forgotten, unsung heroes. For me, Peter Foley is one of them.
He's won so many awards. He got an MBE, got a Kick It Out, top man. So he is recognised in that sort of small community. But yeah, Peter Foley, to me, is a hero.
And as we're in Africa, Ghanaian heritage is the point.
Bill, these are players that have left a rich, added a rich tapestry to the English game. What's noticeable as well about Black Africa, so many Black African players, is the social conscience that they seem to exude as well, and the will and desire to further kind of like the development of ancestral homelands, communities that they've grown up in a way that just doesn't seem to be matched certainly not from a European perspective, from the European contemporaries.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think we should. It's not universal, let's say. I mean, Arthur Wharton came from a very respectable middle class religious background. Effie Sodger, remember the guy with the bandana who split for Nigeria? He went to boarding school in Nigeria. So, you know, there were examples of where people were quite well-to-do. But I think more generally, yeah, people, the contrast is remarkable, isn't it? You come across to England and you start earning even £2,000 a week, and you look at your family back in Africa and think, wow, you know, that I could do a lot for that. Certainly a player called Yul Mawawi, who was Fleetwood's first black player, his father came from a village in the middle of the Congo, very, very isolated village. But luckily, he was a bright young man. He won a scholarship to go to France to be educated, where he met Yul's mother-to-be, and Yul was brought up in France. But they never forgot where they came from in the Congo. And certainly his father was responsible for getting, you know, clean water and things as basic as that there. And Yul has followed suit. He, you know, he really, really feels he owes something to his, you know, to his heritage. So there are lots of examples of African footballers who do give an awful lot back. I mean, we know about Mane, what he does. Dave, I think you've got an example of from West Brom as well. So, yeah, people do want to give something back, I think. And they realise how lucky they are.
Yeah, David, Yusuf Malumbu, your experiences talking to him.
Yeah, I mean, I remember interviewing him. I mean, we were in the Premier League at that point. I think Yusuf must have played in a couple of hundred games for the Albion, most of it in the Premier League. And he I remember interviewing him once for the programme, and he was born in Congo, in Kinshasa. His father fled the country when he was one to avoid the war, and then sent for the family when he'd settled in Paris. And Yusuf said to me, you know, that one of the things that as African players that we often have is a big responsibility to our families back home in Africa, the ones who are still there. If there's any problem, we're the first port to call. We're the first person that they turn to, because obviously, you know, earning Premier League money or League Two money, as Bill says, you know, it's a huge difference. And, you know, he said that perhaps early on in his career, he found that tough. You know, when he was 17, 18, he found that too big a responsibility. But as he got older, you know, it was something that he came to relish in the fact that he wasn't just playing football for himself and for his own benefit. He was doing it for his family and to help them out and to give them a better life and, you know, just ease the burden a bit. I think, you know, he said a lot of African players play with that in mind. And, you know, I think, you know, we criticise players for moving from club to club and all that kind of stuff. And not having the loyalty that we fans have and all that kind of thing. Yeah, you think of somebody like Malumbu. Well, if somebody's going to offer him more money and he can send that money back home to people who need it, why are you not going to take the money? And I think that while that becomes something that we perhaps criticise players for, I think it's probably admirable, actually.
Bill mentioned Yul Mawawi. I mean, I think he was Fleetwood Town's first black player. Now, Fleetwood Town in the football pyramid is not earning... Yeah, he's earning a tiny fraction of what a Premier League player is earning. So, but he's still giving money, you know, for him, he's giving money back to his local community, because although he's earning, yeah, I might call it chicken meat, but he's earning low wages by English football standards, it's still huge compared to the sort of living standards back home where he came from. So I think, and Sadio Mane, I think you might want to say something about Sadio Mane, because obviously he's at the other end of the footballing spectrum. He's at the Premier League, he's probably getting very, very, very good wages, and yet he's similarly motivated to give stuff back to his local community. And so it's not just a kind of, I'm very rich, I can afford to do it. It's kind of, I'm a bit richer than my people at home, I can afford to do it. It's kind of it's kind of an African thing. That might be an exaggeration, but it definitely seems to be a trend.
Yeah, I mean, the Sadio Mane, you know, situation, you know, massive amounts of admiration, you know, widespread admiration amongst Liverpool supporters for his actions. And, you know, he's built his hometown, you know, hospitals, you know, schools, you know, and it's awe-inspiring when a player does, you know, something like that, you know, wherever they come from. But it's you know, amazing to see. You know, and it stands out with black African footballers that, it goes beyond that. You know, it's you know, kind of creating infrastructure for you know, homelands, and it really is, you know, inspiring, really. You know, Bill, you want to mention Chris Kamara's dad as amongst this as well.
Yeah, you know, what these players have been talking about have done is absolutely brilliant, commendable. But in a way, they've given out of their wealth. Chris Kamara's dad, who was from Sierra Leone, Chris recalls that his dad would occasionally disappear. And what he was doing was going back to Sierra Leone, taking food, clothing, and so on. So he was very poor. I mean, Chris was brought up in a very sort of poor background. So his dad went across and did exactly the same thing, but he did it out of poverty. And I think I did some research, and I reckon I found that his dad was a stowaway on at least one occasion. So he couldn't even afford the fare back to Sierra Leone, but he was still rich enough relatively to be able to go back and support his family back in Sierra Leone. So it's kind of a tradition or a cultural thing, really. If you know, if you've got more than you need, you can go and help your relatives back in Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dave, Ebola, I mean, it's a form of socialism, you know, that is absolutely, you know, inherent amongst all this. You know, it's exactly something, you know, someone like Bill Shankly would massively approve of this. You know, you have more on your plate than you need. You help the next person along. You know, it's stunning, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is stunning, which is a great pity, because, you know, it should be obvious, really, shouldn't it? I think it's something that the developed world, the Western world, however you want to describe it, I think it's something that we've lost, and we're all desperately peddling away to try and get more and more and more, and to pinch as much off the other bloke as we possibly can. And, you know, I think there's it's not just an African thing. I think you see it in other parts of the world where, you know, a lot of people are struggling. There's a community, there's a willingness to help one another. They understand that they stand on one another's shoulders, or they all fall over together. And if we could have a bit of that back, we'd have a better country as well, I think.
Indeed.
Yes. David, I mean, this kind of, it may, it, what's great about this as well is yeah, obviously the benefits, you know, the tangible benefits that, you know, that these players are offering, you know, wider communities that they grew up in. But it's also, you know, an education for generations, you know, of children who look on players like Sadio Mane and so many others as role models. That will be a lasting legacy. You know, it's that trickle down effect of what you know, Pandora's box in a way. But you know, it's that those doors that then open beyond these gestures.
Yes, you're right. I think that. Perhaps I think there's stuff going on in the background that most fans don't know about. And I think probably a lot of players do this kind of thing, but it's not, they don't necessarily trumpet about it and make a big thing about it. Now, I know that fans can resent the enormous sums that some of these players earn. I mean, I'm thinking particularly at the moment of a Palace player, Wolf Zaha, who I know is Marmite for most football fans up and down the country, so that's fine. But yeah, he's always trying to negotiate better and better contracts out of Palace, and they always give him whatever he wants, really. And so he's earning phenomenal sums of money, which I think many Palace fans tend to resent. But in the background, he's doing huge amounts of work for charity, and I think that's so often overlooked. I'm not here to defend Wilf Zaha in particular, just an example of somebody who does earn huge amounts of money, but who actually contributes ever such a lot back into his community, both South London community and also back in Africa. So, and I don't think that's necessarily always seen. It's kind of hidden from most fans, I suspect.
Well, Bill, I mean, within that, it's that they're always the most heartwarming of the stories that come along when they'll come out of not on purpose. There'll be stories that kind of leak out via a third party. You know, it's heartwarming that, you know, in the way that they want to give, when a player wants to give but isn't, you know, doesn't want the, you know, the trumpeting for it. They're not after publicity, and in a way, they you know, it's always telling. Quite go back to Sadio Mane, but you know, he's always come across as very humble in everything that he's doing in that respect, and he doesn't want, you know, what glory, what adoration he wants is simply for what he does on a football pitch rather than what he is doing in social terms.
Yeah, because I think that's how it came out, isn't it? Somebody semi-criticised him for not having something really fancy like a telephone or mobile, something like that. And that was what led him to explain why he doesn't need these material goods. I mean, a lot of the players that we looked at, to be fair, were not earning great sums of money, because you're talking about a long, long time ago. Abbe Johansson never earned a lot of money, although relatively, he would have been earning more than his parents did previously. So, you know, in terms of the book and the first black players at each of the clubs, very few of them were getting paid mega bucks. So I'm not really, really aware of them matching Marnie in any sort of way.
The successes, the greatest successes, African players in English football, you know, the ones to achieve on the pitch, you know, where do you see, you know, the great successes of the English game as far as African football is concerned, black African footballers are concerned? I'll throw that to the room. Anyone who wants to jump on that one, go for it.
Can I nominate Albert Johansson in terms of he kind of brought the mould? He was the first black footballer that reached great prominence. You know, Match of the Day had only just started. The Beatles were big. And Albert became quite a celebrity. So I think he brought the mould, but it also broke him. He didn't survive, but he didn't cope very well with the fame. When he came to England, he wasn't a drinker. He drank to become sociable, to make him feel more confident. But the other thing that most people don't know is that both of his parents were alcoholics. So, you know, is it genetic? I don't know. But I would go for Albert in terms of breaking the mould. And he certainly paved the way for a lot of people that followed. A lot of people that we spoke to thought Albert Johansson was the first black footballer ever. I mean, he wasn't even the first black footballer at Leeds. But he's so famous and his profile is so high, people say, oh, yeah, he was the first black footballer. So that would be my nomination.
Excellent nomination, Bill. Either the Davids to...
I'm going to make a nomination, then I'm not going to talk about him because I want either Bill or David to talk about him. But Tony Collins, I mean, I read the book when it came out and I was reading it again today before we did this podcast. But, I mean, that is an extraordinary story. I mean, he's in three different clubs. I'll let one of you two tell the story. I think he's a fascinating character. You should have his own film or something.
He is a fascinating character. And in fact, of course, he was the first black player. More, those were the only ones that happened to be in the Football League and happened to be in our book. But I mean, I think I'm right in saying he was also the first black player at Torquay. And I think Bill may correct me, but I think also at York.
Probably Sheffield Wednesday as well, or he didn't make the first team.
Yeah, I mean, he is an interesting character. He also illustrates the fact that they didn't earn all that much, because, I mean, it's clear from Tony Collins' book, he makes it clear, or his daughter makes it clear, that he would move regularly from club to club because the wages weren't necessarily all that great, but the signing on the fee actually dwarfed the wages. So he could move, he could work, he could play for Watford, then he could move to Crystal Palace, and you know, the wages were dwarfed by the signing on fee he got, which, oh, I went out and bought a house. I was able to afford to buy a house with a signing on fee. So that gives you an idea, I think, of how things have shifted. Tony Collins was never a rich man, but he was able to afford eventually to buy a car and to buy a modest house, I think, in Rochdale. He also, of course, made the contribution of being the first black manager and quite a successful manager within the terms that he was allowed. I mean, he was manager of, I'm saying, it was Rochdale. He led them to a League Cup final, which they did lose. But nonetheless, they were, I think, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think they were in the fourth division at the time, and they got to the final of the League Cup. Which was a pretty good achievement. I think Tony Collins might be better known if he hadn't... He kind of made the mistake of saying, I've taken Rochdale as far as I can, I'm going to resign. I think he did it in expectation that he'd get an offer from another club, but it never, ever came. So he never did manage another team after that. I think he was assistant manager at Bristol City, I think, for a while, but he never got another job as manager. So, I mean, he was a first black player at, so I think, at least five or six clubs. He was the first black manager. His heritage, just worth saying a bit about his heritage, I think, because I contacted his daughter about his heritage, and she said, yes, we've had a DNA, because he came from a single parent family, and basically his mother never ever declared who the father was. But Tony's daughter Sarita said, yeah, we've had a DNA test and we know what his heritage is, and I'm happy about it, but there are members of the family who would prefer not to say. However, if you read the book that she co-wrote, there are sufficiently very heavy hints in there for you to be able to say, well, he was of Nigerian heritage. It's pretty clear, really. So it's interesting how people regard that, having that heritage. Some people aren't happy about having it made public. Clearly, there are members of Tony Collins' family who would prefer to keep that quiet, which I think is a great shame. But you have to remember that Tony Collins' mother was a single parent, a young single parent, so had a relationship with a black Nigerian, I think probably a sailor, and her life must have been made hell, really, because A, you shouldn't be a single parent in the 1930s, which is when he was born, and you definitely shouldn't be have a black father for your child. So she had it really tough. I believe when Tony Collins came to sign up for the army, or was enlisted, was conscripted into the army for World War II, his mother wrote and said, I don't want him to enlist. His father's been given such a rough time by the British authorities. I don't want him fighting for Britain. And she actually enlisted the help of the Nigerian High Commission to write a letter to try and get him out of service. I don't think Tony was necessarily that bothered either way. I think he'd have preferred not to serve. But nonetheless, that shows you that his father had a really tough time with the British authorities. And it also illustrates how difficult it must have been for the mother to sort of be a single parent in that situation. So there are all sorts of very interesting aspects of Tony Collins' story, and he does deserve to be better known. And I think we've done him a bit of justice in the book.
A name that should be widely known. Briefly moving away from the English game, Dave, black Africans in global terms. Zaire at the 1974 World Cup were an unlucky benchmark for many, many decades to come, and also a misunderstood entity. A wonderful football team in their own right. The 1974 World Cup wasn't really representative of what they had to offer, but the visuals of that World Cup did a lot of lasting damage. They were pointed and laughed at. There's Danny Baker DVDs out there where fun is being taken of. I don't have to mention that free kick, but this is the unfortunate nature of it. Through decades to come, even at the 1990 World Cup, Cameroon were seen as something of a circus act. They got to the quarterfinals, and even then they were being viewed as quite savage in their approach at times, which there was that element to them, but they magnificently could play. An achievement in reaching the quarterfinals that prompted Pelé to suggest that there would be an African World Cup winner before the end of the century. Never quite happened. Senegal would follow in the footsteps of Cameroon in reaching the quarterfinals of the 2002 World Cup. We've had Ghana 2006. But those preconceived notions that Zaire unfortunately projected to the world took a long time to overcome.
We paid a lot of attention to it in this country. And when I say this country, I mean Britain as opposed to England, because obviously they were in the same group as Scotland, and the first game was against Scotland. Scotland won 2-0. And after that game, I mean, it was, they'd given a good account of themselves, to use the cliche. But, I mean, it all sort of fell apart with that Yugoslavia game, and they lost 9-0. And then, as you say, there's the free kick thing, and it was all these guys who just happened to turn up at the World Cup, and they didn't really know the rules, and they didn't quite know what they were there for, was a ridiculous caricature of what actually went on and happened. And again, I think it was 3-0 against Brazil in the final game. I mean, they were nowhere near the side that people have made them out to be in the 50 years that have intervened. But I mean, that was where all those, they're tactically naive, they can't be organised, and they play their own game and all that kind of stuff. Well, that kind of rubbish sort of spouted from, and as you say, it took forever for that to be played in. I mean, I suppose Cameroon, as you say, sometimes they were a bit agricultural in their tactics, but I mean, that was a World Cup that Argentina got to the final, and nobody was saying that about them. They had a bloke sent off virtually every 20 minutes. So, I think Roger Miller didn't help, with his celebrations. I think that played into that kind of stereotype, didn't it, a little bit, you know? And it was all very much bless them, you know, here they are, they're trying hard, and that kind of nonsense. And I don't suppose it was till 94 was, and all of a sudden Nigeria were taken seriously when we got to 1994 after the Olympics and so on. And there was, you know, talk that, oh, they might go on and be a, you know, they might go on and win the World Cup here and that kind of stuff, which was obviously a bit premature. It's taken a long time for that to, you know, to be played down. And I think as well, you know, in terms of individual players from Africa as well, you know, perhaps somebody like Drogba could have been closer to winning the Ballon d'Or at some stage in the, you know, the intervening 20-odd years since Nigeria were taken seriously. Dropping a cliche alert here, the fact that a lot of African sides play like they're enjoying it, that seems to be a bad thing, you know. The pundits and the commentators, we can't be having people that are actually enjoying this business. I mean, they should be looking miserable as sin like everybody else does. And, you know, I think that plays into the, oh, well, it's a little bit of a job for them, they don't take it seriously, and, you know, they're not properly prepared and all that crap. It's just, you know, it's colonialism still out
it
there,
is.
Really.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, I was a bit, when you mentioned this might, something you might want to talk about tonight, I was sort of a bit surprised. Why on earth are we going to be talking about this 50 years after the event? That seems quite a strange thing to do, really. So I kind of did a bit of a Google search to find out, you know, what lay behind all of this. And it was, I don't know if you may be aware of this, I certainly wasn't until today, that the team were actually threatened by the president's bodyguards, the president of the country, the president of Zaire. He sent his bodyguards over to say, you know, if you lose by more than 3 goals to Brazil, you are not coming home. And so they were under, you know, severe sort of emotional stress. I understand they hadn't been paid what they thought they were due to have been paid. And so the guy who ran out the wall was basically he was expressing his intense frustration about the fact he hadn't been paid, which, let's face it, is a reasonable thing to be frustrated about. But he was also booting the ball as far away as possible to kill a bit of time, because they didn't want to concede that third goal, which eventually they did. But I mean, I was completely oblivious to that. And I think it was John Motson, God rest his soul, who kind of made the sort of, on the commentary, made some comment about, oh, they don't know the rules, they don't really understand what's going on, which was a complete misrepresentation of what this situation actually was. They were being pressurized by their own president, and they were, you know, they acted under extreme duress, really. They threatened to withdraw from the second game against Yugoslavia because they hadn't been paid. So there's a whole background. I mean, as I said, I knew none of this until today, but there's a whole background to that incident, which I don't know how generally it's known now.
I wrote an article, it's why I wanted to put it in there, a few years ago it was, and it was actually picked up by a lecturer at Solent University, and he uses it as part of his syllabus now. And yeah, Moepra Lunga, there was a degree of, it was panic, basically, you know, the threats. And that was a team that could play. And they were, I think I named it the misrepresentation of Zaire, I think I named the article. And yeah, it always struck as a resonance to me, and just how, you know, that whole World Cup for them was misrepresented, you know, and Dave used the, you know, the perfect word in you know, caricature, you know, a cartoon was, you know, cartoon element was basically propelled, and that word of mouth that spread, and that danger of you know, misrepresentation that can just echo on and on. And we, you know, we've spoken on many podcasts about how, you know, what can be said at the point of impact can be, you know, reverberate for many, many years. And yeah, I've always found it, you know, fascinating is not the right word, but, you know, it's always stuck in my craw, you know, that, and it's that reverberation through African football, and, you know, and that the way that it would wash over into, you know, the black African players that came to the English game, because they were for a long, long time seen with, I don't know, scepticism, you know, as a peculiarity. I remember Daniel Amakachi being an Everton player, and the reaction amongst Everton supporters to Amakachi, you know, at the time was billed as Everton's first black player, but that then, you know, it was, that was Cliff Marshall, and you know, going further back as well. So yeah, that always fascinated me, that aspect of Zaire in 74 and those repercussions and that reverberation that kind of carried on for like 20, 30 years really. And it's a the likes of Didier Drogba, it's his kind of generation that's it took a long time to alter those preconceptions, which a sad fascination, I suppose, in that respect. Going back back to closer to home, within that, the legacy of Black African players in the English game, both decades, a century ago, up to present day. Where do we see the shift from start to finish there, Bill? If we look at Black African players of today compared to the predecessors, those initial trailblazers. Where is that? Where does that legacy stand now? Difficult question, but we'll try and put the hat on as best we can.
I mean, there really is no comparison, is there, in terms of stature, profile, number. If you go back to the early African players, let's say Wharton, he would invariably be the only black person, not just on the pitch, but in the crowd. The reporters would be white, the police would be white. So, what one black face, abuse was normal. Nobody stopped them abusing. If you read the newspaper reports from that time, it's very rare that we'll not make reference to the colour. I mean, and sometimes they use the N-word in newspapers going back to that time. So it would be very, very rare for him not to be known as Darkie, at least. And that was openly accepted. And he couldn't do anything about it. He's a lone voice. And now we move on to, well, does anybody notice the colour of skin now? You watch a match now and it's 22 players. It's not as if there's only going to be one black person there. So I think it's just changed completely, and there really is no comparison.
I think maybe what hasn't changed is black managers. I mean, I think Bill and I have discussed this, quite a few times, really. I think Bill spoke to Viv Anderson, who said, when he became manager at Barnsley, I think the expectation was that he was the first of many, and he expected many others to follow in his footstep. And I think I believe when he spoke to Bill, he said, it just simply hasn't happened. If you look around you now in the Football League, how many black managers are there? I mean, I'm quite proud of the fact that Palace had one briefly until they sacked him after 18 months. But there are just so few black managers. It seems it's very hard to explain. But I know Bill's spoken to a number of players, ex-players, who've all put forward views on it. I think some of them put forward quite similar views. I'll let you speak because you've spoken to them. But I think managers is one area where it hasn't changed, and perhaps it does need to.
Yeah, I mean, the most common reason given was that, in their words, until those upstairs change, nothing's going to change anywhere else. And what they mean is, until owners are black, until directors are black, then people tend to recruit in their own image, don't they? So I think that the big thing is we need black ownership, we need black people on boards and so on. Some of them said things like, it's our fault, because we give in too easily. We don't apply because we think we've got no chance. But when you look around at the records, I mean, Chris Kamara's forgotten as a manager, but he actually took Bradford to promotion. His task was to keep Bradford in the second division. He failed. He actually got them promoted. So that there have been good black managers, but they tend not to get a second chance, whereas perhaps others get a chance earlier and they get more chances. So yeah, it's a big problem that hasn't got better. As David said, Viv Anderson thought it was a big change 30 years ago. This is the beginning of having lots of black managers, but totally disproportionate, isn't it? It can't be logical. You've got 30% of players black and perhaps 5% of managers and coaches black. One or two said we're regarded as useful, not leaders, but we could be coaches, but they don't see us as leaders. They don't see us as managers. It's taken an awful long time to change that mind.
And Dave, we've spoken about this on podcasts before, about how black managers are very, very few and far between. And I think Bill comes up with the pertinent point is that it's the people who, that do the hiring and firing in this respect. It's, until we have a generation of owners and directors who are, of a generation who've watched football through the eyes of someone who does not differentiate between white and black players, it's unlikely to change anytime soon.
I'm going to repeat things that we have said in podcasts before. Things have changed a lot on the field, and they've changed a lot on the field because if a bloke can stick the ball in the net from 18 yards, doesn't matter, it can be green, they don't care, because he'll score the goals that win the game and bring the money in. They don't care. They'll pick anybody that can do that. They are colourblind in that sense. I've worked at West Brom for a long time, and the point that this is not specific to West Brom, the point that I'm going to make, it's about, I've been to football clubs up and down the country, behind the scenes, working on match days, all that sort of stuff. You very rarely see a black face in the media team. You very rarely see a black face in the commercial team, in the accountancy function. You might see one or two in the club shop. And then when you go to a dinner, an end of season dinner, you'll see a big white crowd of people sitting down to a very nice meal. And the MC will say, right, and now dinner will be served. And they'll open the doors at the back of the kitchen, and hundreds of black kids will come out to serve the white people. It's quite a powerful thing when you see that, because it's from 200 years ago, and that's in football, I think in terms of managers, it's a more nuanced thing. Is a manager a good manager or not? As opposed to, can the centre forward score 20 goals? But, one's a fact and one's an opinion. But I think we have to come to the inescapable conclusion that the people who sit at round boardroom tables don't want any black people there with them. It's inescapable, isn't it? I think those are the facts. I mean, I also just the point that Bill made about, we don't notice that there are black players on the pitch anymore. We don't know until one of them misses a penalty. Then we can't notice anything other than the fact that he's black. We've come a long way, but we haven't come very far at the same time.
Great point. And then that's what makes education such a vital tool, and the importance of Black History Month can promote that, and rightly so. As a final point, each of you give me one black African name that resonates to you.
I want to mention Patrick Vieira again, because he was a great player. For Arsenal mainly. Not my favourite team, because they're London, sort of rivals. But nonetheless, he was a great player. I think most people would acknowledge that. I think I'm right in saying he was born in Senegal. He was a black manager. Admittedly, he only lasted 18 months or so, which I think many Palace. It's interesting the reaction of Palace fans when he was appointed. Most people, nobody really mentioned the colour of his skin. They said he hasn't had any Premier League experience. Is he going to be up? Is he going to be up to it? All right. But the first year, people were hugely, hugely positive about Patrick Vieira, the football he had Palace playing. He was very popular, I think, with all the fans. I don't think anybody had reservations, certainly none to do with his colour. Something went wrong in the second year, but it often does with a lot of managers that happens. I'd be very interested to see if he gets another gig as a manager, to be honest, because he's definitely has the potential to be a very good manager. But as Bill mentioned, black managers tend not to get a second chance. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there. But I'm sorry to be Crystal Palace about this, but I'd mentioned Patrick Vieira.
No problem at all. That you can be as partisan as we like in this as well. But I think Patrick Vieira is a wonderful example. Within that, I'd throw there is that, Crystal Palace's clear reluctance and disappointment that his time in charge had come to an end. I think it was one of those. It was an apologetic sacking, as I seem to remember it. They didn't. I think a lot of the noise was, and I don't think this was a case of ticking boxes either. I think this was down to the fact that the football had been entertaining, that he himself was loved by the supporters and the club themselves. It had seemed to be. Bill, can you give us a name that
Well, I've had plenty of time to think about it, and I'm still struggling to come up with a name. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and pick a team. And I'm going to pick Garner. Back to Dave's point about football with a smile on its face. I love the way Garner play football, but it's a whole package as well. I love their fans. They're exuberant, they're colourful, they're enthusiastic. So going to any Garner match is an absolute privilege. So if I could be excused the individual, I'll go for Garner and their fans.
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to drop into the when this was mentioned a bit earlier on, was that I'm very much of the mind that it's Africa has kind of picked up the baton that South America used to have. South America, as many of the nations have tried to Europeanize their game in a way. And we always used to bask in the glow of South American football, and in a way that exuberance, that verve. And a natural flow of the game that I think Africa, kind of has picked up that mantle in so many ways, that style, that swagger, of football, which makes African nations just such a joy to watch, in the international game. And finally, Dave, anyone that you choose to throw into
Yeah,
this mixture.
I think I'll probably be as partisan as David in there. Peter Odemwingie, the great Peter Odemwingie. He covers all the bases really in a lot of ways. I mean, he came to the Albion from playing in Russia, where he was getting terrible racial abuse. And I mean, his first game for us, we unveiled a banner, welcoming him, and the crowd took to him and all that sort of stuff. So that was like a really heartwarming thing. And I mean, we've got the playing football with a smile on your face. I mean, he certainly did that. He was the best goal scorer that the Albion have had over that Premier League era. But also, I mean, again, the caricature. You talk to anybody else about Peter Odemwingie, they'll talk about him sitting in the car outside Loftus Road on transfer deadline day, because of course he was a nutcase and he didn't understand. I know for a fact he was told to go down to QPR on that day, because they were trying to do the deal. I know for a fact that he was given permission to go down there. But again, because he's an African, because he's from Nigeria, oh well, he doesn't really get it, does he? So, in every possible sense, Peter Odemwingie covers everything that we've talked about tonight, I think.
Oh, excellent choices, everyone. A wonderful, wonderful way to spend about an hour and a quarter as well. This has been episode one of five. We will be back for episode two very, very soon. David, thank you for your contributions. A wonderful first episode of the series.
Thank you. Thanks. Been a pleasure as always to talk to you.
Oh, no, thank you. And Bill, thank you so much. Great, great contributions to the podcast tonight.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Dave. Looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Dave, an education.
It has been an education, and I'm looking forward to the next four episodes. I shall try and cut down on the gratuitous mentions of Cyril Regis and Derek Ray and Latin if I possibly can, but I'm making no promises.
No, I'll if you curtail this, I will bring him back into the conversation some way possible. This has been the first episode of our Black Pioneers series. Thank you for listening. Please join us for episode two from These Football Times and the LOB podcast. Goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.